This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Canary. Later this hour, we're going to revisit a conversation we had last May about what motivated early Floridians to move into the swampy, mosquito-infested area of South Florida. But first, NASA's launching a new satellite today. It's the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, better known as TESS. It's going to launch this evening at 6:32 on a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket at Cape Canaveral. The TESS mission is to find planets outside of our solar system known as exoplanets. But some researchers will get to use TESS for other things, including my guest today, Dr. Derek Buzashi. He's a professor and Whitaker Eminent Scholar in the Department of Chemistry and Physics here at Florida Gulf Coast University. He got his undergraduate degree in physics from the University of Chicago and his PhD in astronomy from Penn State University. He's worked at a number of institutions over the years, most recently for 10 years as professor of physics at the U.S. Air Force Academy. We've brought him on the show today because he's going to have a chance to use the new TESS Space Telescope to continue research he started in the late 1990s. He joins us by phone from Kennedy Space Center, where he's patiently awaiting this evening's launch. Dr. Buzashi, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on. It's hard to be patient as the countdown progresses, but I'm trying.
out there in Radio Land, if you'd like to join our conversation, the lines are open. Give us a call. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Dr. Buzashi, tell us, set the scene for us. Where are you now? How long have you been over there? What's going on?
I got here yesterday, so right now I'm actually at the media center talking to folks like you, actually, about the mission in general and my role in it. And then later this afternoon we'll go out to the viewing site and hold our breaths while the rocket ignites and takes our baby up into space.
Have you been there before for launches?
I have been here before for launches, although it's been a while. The last launch I was at was the Kepler Space Telescope launch, which was back in 2009, and then before that for a couple of shuttle launches and then two previous NASA missions that I was involved in.
Will this be your first SpaceX launch instead of a NASA launch?
It is my first SpaceX launch, so that's interesting. It'll be interesting to see the differences. I mean, it's awesome to see the first stage come back down. We won't sadly get to see it because it'll be coming down 160 miles away from us. But even knowing that it's happening and seeing it on video is a kind of magical thing.
That was actually a question I was going to ask you later, is whether it was going to land back there. You know, it's funny how early sci-fi got it right. You know, who'd have thought that we would actually be landing our rockets vertically like they imagined way back when?
Yeah, that's right. It's really impressive. I mean, I guess when they first started talking about doing it, I believed them that it was possible, but what impresses me is how quickly they've managed to make it a reality.
Yeah, no doubt. So before we get to your research, just give our listeners an overview of TESS. What makes it different? You know, how big of a leap forward is it for this search for exoplanets?
So probably your listeners are aware of Kepler, which is the currently operating mission, which will cease operating any day now, we keep saying, because it's running very, very low on fuel. And Kepler found most of the exoplanets that we found, so planets outside our solar system. And TESS is kind of a follow-on to Kepler, but the missions have some differences as well. Kepler stared basically for 4 years at one patch of sky, and its goal was to go and find out how common are exoplanets. At that point, we knew they existed when we launched Kepler, and we detected a few, but we didn't know how common they were. So Kepler looked at this pre-selected group of stars in one area of the sky and figured out, how common are exoplanets? How common are rocky exoplanets like the one that we live on? Those kinds of questions. TESS is different because TESS is going to look at the whole sky. So not all at once, but in strips. So over 2 years, it'll cover the whole sky. And the stars that it's looking at when it searches for exoplanets are much brighter than the stars that Kepler looked at. They're about, on average, about 100 times brighter. And they're brighter because they're closer to us. And what that means is that the planets that TESS finds are much easier for us to do follow-up work on. So, for example, with Kepler, we could find a planet and decide that it was probably a rocky planet, but there wasn't much more that we could do in terms of going to look to see if they had an atmosphere or doing follow-up work on what is that atmosphere made of. Even the biggest telescopes we have, whether on the ground or in space, aren't really big enough to do that kind of work for most of the Kepler planets. But for TESS, that's different. The TESS planets will be close enough and the stars that they orbit bright enough that if we find rocky planets, we'll actually be able to go for the majority of them to go and see whether they have atmospheres and what those atmospheres are made of. So that's pretty exciting.
Why did we not look at the brighter stars using Kepler? What was the rationale behind that?
Well, brighter stars are, of course, much less common, so most stars are faint. And so what Kepler wanted to do was to be able to look at a large number of stars in a very stable way, because we're looking for very, very small signals. So the less you change about how you're looking at things, the better off you are. So staring in one place is a lot more stable than sort of zooming around and looking at different parts of the sky. And if you want to look at a lot of stars all at once, since most of them are faint, that's what you're going to get. You're going to get, in Kepler's case, about 200,000 relatively faint stars. But you have the ability to do it all in one look. So it's kind of just a different observing philosophy. You get something a little bit different out of it. So TESS, Kepler's kind of a pathfinder for TESS. TESS, in a way, is a pathfinder as well. I mean, TESS is effectively like a finder telescope in some ways for missions like the James Webb Space Telescope and the next generation of very large ground-based observatories that are coming online.
So TESS is...
Because those are the ones that are going to be able to do the follow-up.
Gotcha. So TESS will find the ones that are most likely, or the ones that we'll want to follow up on. TESS will determine those, and then once James Webb gets up there in a few years, then it can drill down on what TESS has brought back.
Exactly. And you want to do it that way because, James Webb, big astronomy telescopes are kind of looking at the sky through a straw. You see this tiny little patch of sky. And so James Webb can look at kind of one of these stars at a time. So it's not efficient to use James Webb to look for planets, right? Because you need to look at many, many stars to find even a few planets. So you can't really use James Webb to find them. But once you know they're there, it's the ideal tool to go and do follow-up work.
Gotcha. So does TESS have multiple lenses, or what makes it able to see so much of the sky?
So it has four small telescopes, and they really are small telescopes. They're a little more than 4 inches across, so they look like kind of camera lenses on steroids. And the four of them are arranged so that their fields kind of line up. So each one takes a rectangle of the sky, and they're kind of stacked on top of each other, so you get this long rectangle. And this 24 degrees across and 96 degrees high, so this is a big swath of the sky. And so essentially, you're looking at a lot of real estate. So Kepler was about 100 square degrees, which is something like 0.5% of the sky. And TESS is going to be looking at more like, about 2,500 square degrees. So a big chunk of the sky at any one time. So a different kind of mission, and you can get away with that because you're looking at bright stars.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is if you try to look at faint stars in such a wide field of view, they all blend together because there's so many of them, but the bright ones are easier to do that way.
That makes sense. So how long have you been waiting for this day? At what point did you've probably been aware of TESS for a while, but when did you become involved as someone who's going to get to use it?
I've been aware of TESS probably for close to 10 years. I mean, the mission has been around in one form or another as a plan for 13 years or so. So I was aware of it pretty early, even before it was really selected as a mission. And then I've become more and more focused on it over the last few years as Kepler has addressed some of the questions that we're interested in and then looking ahead to TESS to go deeper on some of these questions. So, I mean, I guess my real focus on it has been the last maybe 2 years or so. So not all that long, especially compared to the people who have built it and planned it and worked on it for more than a decade. Space missions, even small space missions, and TESS is not a huge mission like Hubble is or James Webb, but even small space missions take the better part of a decade or longer and a huge fraction of a lot of people's lives.
How did the process work of you pitching a proposal for this mission?
So TESS has a guest investigator program, and you can propose any kind of science that you think might be appropriate for TESS that it might do well. So you write a proposal, and then there's a panel of scientists that sit down. The proposals are kind of broken up, so the ones that are dealing with sort of extragalactic things in cosmology are viewed by one panel, and the stellar ones are viewed by another, and the exoplanet by another, so that you have people with expertise in the field looking at each one. And they sit down and they read and discuss each over several days. It's a very competitive process. And then they provide NASA with something like a ranked list. And NASA makes the final decision, but normally they typically go with what the panel recommends. And then, you know, they play a balancing game as well, because when you talk to them, typically you say, this is how much data I need to do the science that I'm interested in. And, of course, they only have so much available to go around, and so they have to kind of balance, you know, how good is your science, how much data are you asking for, how much support do you need to make this happen, and then they approve and fund based on that.
Needless to say, you're probably pretty
excited. It takes a while, so it's a I was very, very excited.
You were very excited. Yeah. We are talking about the launch of a new space telescope called TESS during this part of today's show. NASA plans to launch it this evening on a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket from Cape Canaveral. My guest is Dr. Derek Buzashi. He's going to get the chance to do some research with the TESS telescope. If you'd like to ask him a question or make a comment, give us a call now. The number is 877-428-8255, 877-GCU-TALK, or you can go to Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. There's a post there. You can ask questions there. Or on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So now let's pivot to the work you'll be doing, but let's start with a summary of what you were doing back in the 1990s. I read that article in the New York Times about it, and it was really fascinating. So can you give us a summary of that?
Sure. So in 1999, NASA launched a mission called WIRE, which was an Explorer-class satellite, kind of like TESS in the sort of the same scale. And WIRE's mission was to go and perform an infrared survey of the sky. And to do that, you need the instruments to be really cold. So it had had a big block of solid hydrogen on board to cool the instruments. And unfortunately, due to a really unfortunate series of events, they lost control of the telescope. They lost control of the spacecraft. And by the time they regained control, they had lost all their coolant. So they were no longer able to operate cold, which meant that they couldn't do their primary mission. So they had a working spacecraft, but their main instrument wasn't functioning. And it occurred to me when I read about this that, in fact, there was a working instrument on board. It was the Little Guide Telescope, which is a little 2-inch telescope. So it's about the size of half of a pair of binoculars. And they use that to tell them where to point the telescope. But that was still working, and we could try to use that to do science. And it sounds silly. It's a tiny little telescope, but it's above the Earth's atmosphere, and so that's a huge difference. All the twinkling that we see when we look at the stars, you know, which sounds so romantic and looks so pretty, is horrible for astronomers because we're looking for tiny little changes in the light output, and you can't see that if the atmosphere swamps them. So even a small telescope above the atmosphere you can do some great things with. So I propose that we try to use this telescope to do something called astroseismology, to study stellar oscillations. And they approved a pilot study, and so we ran it for a few weeks and decided we were able to do it. And we ended up running the spacecraft for about 7 years and observed almost 200 stars spread around the sky, doing this sort of high-precision measurement, which is the same thing that Kepler and TESS are doing, but this was, of course, a lot earlier in the game.
And you were the first person to document a star quake on a star other than our sun. Did I get that right?
So... yeah, sort of. I mean, you know, there are some stars. So we're looking at something called stellar oscillations, and some stars have oscillations that are very large and easy to detect, but most of them are harder. And the sun's case is very, very difficult. So what we're interested in doing this for is that these stars, they oscillate, and the oscillations are really sound waves traveling around inside the star. And as the sound waves kind of bounce around, they change the shape of the star in very small ways. And we can, of course, measure the sound from the stars because sound doesn't travel through space, but we can measure those tiny little changes in the shape because they lead to little changes in the light output. And so we measure this sort of these periodic changes. So that matters because, so here's an analogy for you. You have a bell, you ring a bell, and you get a note or a collection of notes out of it. It makes a sound that you recognize. And if you change what the bell is made of or you change how big the bell is, you get a different sound out of it. And so in theory, if you know enough and you work hard enough, you could actually listen to the sound and figure out what the shape of the bell was and what the bell is made of. And that's what we try to do with these stars. We measure the notes by measuring how the light output changes in these tiny ways with time, and then we use that to infer how the stars are built on the inside, how big they are, how old they are, all these things that astronomers would really like to know but are actually quite difficult to do. And back in 1999, I was the first one to do this from space.
Hmm. So did you ever dream back then that you'd be here today awaiting launch of TESS or something like it that would allow you to continue your work from back then?
No. I mean, I knew that we'd have further spacecraft, but, you know, you never, the process of even getting a space mission approved and launched is very competitive, and so you never really know what's going to come. And really, you know, the stellar angle, sort of doing the astroseismology, studying the stellar oscillations, you know, is really exciting to me and is really exciting to a lot of people, but it doesn't have the same kind of sort of public curb appeal that other things do, like in particular exoplanets. And
right.
So we're sort of riding on the exoplanet bandwagon because the kind of quality of data that they need, they're also looking for tiny little variations in the light output as a function of time, but they're looking for different kinds of variations for different reasons. But the quality of the data and the kind of instruments they need are the same as what we need. And so it's really convenient for us that they build these instruments, you know, that are good for them, but they also are good for us.
So you got to use WIRE for 7 years, you said. So were you, after that mission ended, until now, were you studying this, astroseismology? Did I get that right?
Astroseismology?
Were you
oscillations is maybe easier.
Okay, stellar oscillations. Were you studying those same stars in the intervening years using other technologies, or will you be returning to these stars now for the first time?
So some of them, I mean, we can do seismology, we can do stellar oscillations with other missions. So Kepler, for example, you can do stellar oscillations with. But remember that the stars that Kepler looked at were pretty faint. And the stars that I'm using TESS to look at are all bright stars. And they're bright stars because they're massive stars. They're 10, 20, 30 times the mass of the sun. And so, you know, those stars are much brighter intrinsically, and they're much brighter in the sky as well. And Kepler didn't really observe very many of those. So the ones that are accessible to us through TESS, you know, Kepler couldn't see. The ones I observed with WIRE back in the late 90s and early 2000s, those are the same stars that we're going to go look at with TESS. And so this is a really, really interesting aspect of this, because we are able to return to stars that we observed maybe 20 years ago. And this is really unique. There's not another data set sitting around where people have looked at stars with this kind of precision 20 years ago, and now we can say, oh, we're going to go back and look again and see how things have changed. And that's really the most interesting part of this, is not only that we're going to be able to do stellar oscillations to measure them and figure out how the interiors of the stars are built, but we can also ask ourselves, has there been any change over the intervening 20 years? And usually you think in astronomy everything takes forever, right? I mean, nothing changes over sort of human timescale. Well, the sun is going to be here for another 5 billion years, and in 20 years the sun's not going to change very much on the inside. But these high-mass stars, they live much shorter, faster lives, and so 20 years is a much more significant time period for them. And so we expect, based on what the theorists who model these stars tell us, we expect to be able to see some changes in the internal structure of these stars. And so this is kind of stellar evolution, you know, the changing of stars with time on a human timescale, which we don't normally get to do.
Will the data that you get from TESS be much better than what you were able to collect back in your earlier research?
You know, that's a really good question. I think it will be a little bit better because the telescope is a little bit bigger. It's about twice the diameter of the WIRE telescope. And, of course, the technology with the detectors and the electronics is a little bit better than it was back then. So I think it will be better. I don't think it's going to be dramatically better, but it will be somewhat better. You know, the big difference really is that with WIRE back then, you know, 20 years ago, we could only do this for the very, very brightest stars, whereas with TESS we can go quite a bit fainter. So TESS is certainly more capable than what we were capable of in those days. But these stars are all pretty bright, and my expectation is the TESS data will be better, but not dramatically better.
Gotcha. This might be a sort of strange question, but since you were the first person to observe this, you know, solar oscillation using a telescope outside of our atmosphere, when you go back and look at these stars, do you feel like a sense of connection, or almost even maybe ownership or something like that? Is that a weird question to ask a person like you?
It's not, and I do, and it's funny because, again, you know, when astronomers look at stars, we usually give them identities which are catalog numbers, right? So they don't really mean much to the average person. They don't even mean much to most astronomers. It's just a string of numbers. But the stars that I observe with WIRE and the stars that I'll observe again with TESS are all bright enough to have names, and so you know, they're stars that human beings have used for navigation for centuries or millennia. And so, yeah, I do feel a lot more connected to them because of that. because I've observed them for such a long time and because they've been important to human beings for such a long time.
So how does it work? What are the mechanics of you using this telescope? Do you go somewhere? Are you able to do it from your lab here at FGCU? How does that work?
I can do it essentially from FGCU. So every month or so, the data get downlinked, get sent back to the Earth. They get processed by NASA to a certain degree. We'll see how good that process is, because with every spacecraft, especially when you're working with very, very high precision like this, there's always sort of a learning curve. But so they'll process the data, then the data will be made available to me through an archive, which is actually hosted at the Space Telescope Science Institute, so I can go then and pull down the data, and then I will do my own processing of the data to try to make sure that any signals that are in it that are due to the instrument, for example, there might be little variations in the temperature of the instrument or how well it points, and those all can show up as little signals in the data. So I have to try to figure out what all those are so that I can remove them. So I'll go and do that, and then we'll be able to do science with the data. And that can take quite a while, especially in the beginning. You know, later on, you sort of understand how everything works better. But in the beginning, you're learning a new instrument, and that takes a certain amount of time.
Last question. So TESS is going to help inform things to look at for the James Webb Space Telescope. Will your work in any way do that as well, or is this sort of an outlier from that project?
No, I think we tie in well, not necessarily to James Webb, although, you know, we could certainly find interesting objects for James Webb to look at, but we sort of tie into a broader science context. So these are the stars, these high-mass stars that we're looking at. These are the ones that are eventually going to go supernova and turn into neutron stars or black holes. And so there's a tie-in to sort of the history of our galaxy and the future of our galaxy, in the sense that these are the stars that sort of spray their heavy elements around, and so the next generation of stars are made up of the stuff that's processed by these stars. Another aspect is that, if you remember, in the last year or two, we have a new field in astronomy, which is gravitational radiation, where we're looking at these neutron stars that coalesce, and as they do that, they actually sort of shake the fabric of the universe, and we measure a gravitational signal from them. And that's a new thing in the last couple of years. The stars that do that, that turn into these coalescing neutron stars, those are the same ones, the same types of stars that I'm going to be looking at. So they have, and this work has an impact on even broader branches of astronomy, even sort of cosmological kinds of astronomy. So you have the cosmological angle, you have the angle where they affect the chemical evolution of the galaxy, which means us, because all the heavy elements that we and our planet are made out of were processed by stars.
Well, that is all the time we have for this part of today's show. I want to thank my guest, Dr. Derek Buzashi. He is a professor and Whitaker Eminent Scholar here at FGCU. He joined us by phone from Kennedy Space Center on Merritt Island. Dr. Buzashi, thanks for your time and enjoy the launch.
Thank you very much.
When we return, we'll find out what drove settlers to move to Southwest Florida. You're listening to Gulf Coast Live on WGCU.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your...